The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this interview. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Mark Walsh.
Pleasure to be here. You guys do great work, so it's a real honor.
Thank you very much. And Mark, I do need your help, as I was saying a minute ago, because we are going to talk about meaning in life, but also how to motivate demoralized people.
Yeah.
And as I was saying, it's very easy for people to get demoralized, especially when we're talking about bad news and when we're talking about the evils of this world. And frequently, if we don't talk about them, few people will talk about them if they end up doing it so. But there is also the other aspect, the aspect of motivating people who very frequently create a comfort zone of feeling bad about themselves, about the system, about the world, about how they fit into the world. I think that you have a very distinctive approach in that there is also some, I'd say, a really positive energy coming from you, and I really hope you can help us with the demoralization of young men and combating it. So welcome to the Lotus Eaters.
Total pleasure, and life is too terrible not to have a sense of humor. You know, yes. I've stared into the abyss in various war zones, and my own family are all deeply mentally ill. I love them. They're great people, but I grew up with some very unwell people. You know, my auntie was a schizophrenic. My cousin was my hero, and he killed himself when I was a teenager. And at the same time, I think Kurt Cobain was my musical hero. So I'm 13 years old. Multiple members of my family are clearly unwell psychologically. My cousin, my hero's killed himself. And the world looked bad, you know? And I've spent the rest of my life going, what do we do about that? Essentially, I have crappy genetics for mental health and meaning. So I've spent the rest of my life since 13 really trying to go, what can I do that's positive, that helps? Been on a journey through martial arts, through psychology, through trauma, for all these different things I've done. And often quite at the sharp end of things, like starting a charity in Ukraine around trauma. You know, some really horrific stuff, horrific stories. I know how bad life can be. I've just been in London, for example, which is absolute Babylon. There's someone in a stab vest on the train. Every time I live abroad and every time I come back to the country, it seems to be worse. My family are now telling me, Mark, we love you, but maybe stay living in Slovenia. And I get why. You know, I'm in London. I'm on the train. I say to them, why is the train gay? And the guy goes, what do you mean? You know, I mean, they shafted me in the ass with the price. But other than that, what I meant was it was like pride colors all over the train. I said, well, that cost me money. You know, this is like really crazy prices as well in the UK. It's crazy money. And he didn't really have a reason for it. He said, it just is. And we support pride. I'm like, well, what's that got to do with me? And little things like that, right up to the serious things. Like I was just in a supermarket and the girl's in a cage. And there's security tags on the meat, and there's a security guard outside the supermarket. And she doesn't, I try and joke to her about it, but she can't speak to me. She doesn't speak English. She can't communicate with me. So there's a million things like that. Essentially, I think we're in what I call the psychological apocalypse. So that mental health meaning has got so bad for so many people, it's no longer viable.
Yeah.
So if there's people watching this who are like, I despair, I get it. Like, I really do. And there are things we can do.
I want to say something about this, and I want to confess, in some respects, I'm a bit guilty, because I was told by my father, basically, unless you have a heart problem, you don't have a problem because he's a heart surgeon and his threshold for what me having a problem is was really high. And I was kind of grown up with that mentality. Mm-hmm. And also in Greece, where I was educated, there wasn't much conversation about mental illness. It's just you focus on just being on your best behavior. Lots of things are demanded of you. You try to do best. If you don't do bad, too bad for you. And then when I started teaching at the university here, I saw there was an influx of people who were saying that they have mental problems and mental diagnosis. Yeah. Now, I will say this. I don't think you can convince me that all of it was sincere.
No.
I think to a very large extent that was insincere. But I will say that for a long time, I just couldn't understand the thing. For instance, I'll just give you an example.
Sure.
And that sounds bad. It may reflect bad for me.
Well, I'd say a healthy stoicism is okay. It's not a bad thing.
Okay, for instance, I'll give you an example. We were told to teach seminars at university. Uh-huh. And we were told to not ask people questions in the seminar because they had mental health issues.
Yeah.
They had social anxiety. They weren't like Pedro Pascal. Well, they weren't allowed to grow people. But they were saying that you have social anxiety. They have social anxiety due to mental health.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you can't have an 80% percentage of the population with mental health, can you?
No. Okay, so we live in the best of times and the worst of times, to quote Dickens. The best of times is we have bread, but man doesn't live off bread alone. So we have electricity, we have the internet, you know, I got a flight here, you know, it's wonderful, it's a great, I'm on internet watching, you know, Harvard lectures on philosophy, it's fantastic. Yeah. You know, I love my life because of that. So materially, we're really well off in materialism. But what we've neglected is the emotional, psychological, and spiritual side of life. So someone from the Middle Ages had terrible dentistry, for example, perhaps, but they had community, they had God, they had all these things that we've lost, and we can break them down. It's four big ones. So that's why I say it's a psychological apocalypse. But there is a complicating factor, which is psychology is cancerously overrun by liberalism. So most psychologists are coming from this woke, materialist, far left point of view, which means they do not believe in personal responsibility. They don't believe in boundaries. And these things define psychological well-being. They don't have, say, a healthy stoicism, for example, if we look at it philosophically. They're in a cult of weakness. And that's definitely not good for people. So yes, you know, I've been in like Afghanistan and stuff, right? If you talk to me about trauma, it better fucking be real trauma. It's not, I couldn't get any oat milk from a latte in East London. Yeah, there's real trauma. There's real trauma and there's not. So it's like, come on, let's get real. Yeah. And we do live in this meaning crisis, John Vervaeke calls it. We do live in this time where, because there's a lack of meaning, it's not really mental health. It's the lack of meaning that's causing people to be unwell.
Yes. Right. So when it comes to talking about meaning, there's a problem that I think exists right now in online discourse, mm-hmm. is that for a long time, we have had people like Jordan Peterson and others who have been saying that there is a sort of, you know, lack of meaning and young men are trying to find it. But the issue is that in online spaces, trends come and go.
Yes.
And the message, lots of people right now say, well, we don't listen to Peterson anymore. Some people will say he went to the Daily Wire and he forgot all of the good things that he said before. And they think essentially that all of that is obsolete, that the picture of Peterson, of personal responsibility, of community, of the picture of the traditional conservative way of finding meaning, if I may say so, is a bit obsolete because they say things like, well, what has conservatism conserved?
Right, true, failed. Yep. They've utterly failed.
But they are essentially trying to do the opposite, something really similar, I'd say, to what the left is doing, which is they're trying to over-intellectualize everything and have a very rigidly top-down view of the world. And where the left says, well, there is no personal responsibility, it's all structures.
Yeah.
Because of these structures, you don't have meaning and you will only find meaning in communism.
Yes.
And now you have the lots of people on the right or further saying, well, because of the structure of the moment right now, there is no way of giving meaning to your life in the traditional sense unless, I don't know what, but because you live in such a society, they sort of say is that this message of personal responsibility is tiring. People have heard many times
and unfair. If you say, well, you just pull your socks up, it's on you. All right, let's break it down. First of all, what a great situation to be in that Peterson and the Lotus Eaters and other people have done so much good work that we're at a point now where that now, you know, Peterson seems old fashioned or whatever, right? Like, that's a great situation. And you guys have done just stellar work in terms of bringing up people's thinking and identifying the problem and pointing at things and saying, stop gaslighting people. These problems exist. That needed to happen. So this has been very good. In terms of why anything happens, first of all, you need what you could call a sufficient anthropology. So it's a sufficient view of human beings, anthropology in the philosophical sense. The model I use is four things. I try and keep it really simple. Often people, left or right, will say the structures and systems, particularly leftist psychologists actually will say that. That's a mistake because you are an individual and can take personal responsibility and change your life and build friendships and brotherhoods, blah, blah. Equally, sometimes people on the right either adopt that and say, oh, it's all doomer because the systems are bad, or they say everything's the individual. And it's kind of like, imagine three games. I'll come to the four things in a minute, but imagine, I don't know, roulette, poker, chess. So on the left, they say it's roulette. It's just all luck. So if you're in a position, Stelios here, doing well, it must just be the patriarchy and you've just been lucky. Okay, and the right says that it's chess. And actually, everything's skill. Everything's not skill. You know, people are born with luckier parents. We have different gifts. We have different positions in society, blah, blah, blah. You know, my dad was alcoholic. Not everyone had that. Okay, there's things that are different for different people. It's more like poker. You do get dealt certain cards by history, by the culture you're in, by your family, your genetics, all those things. Like, I'm short, okay? I'm not particularly tall. I never will be. But I can make up for it with my personality on a good day if I'm lucky. You know, you play the hand you've got. So I think it's more like poker. So that's the first thing I'd say in terms of the balance. In terms of philosopher Ken Wilber talks about quadrants. And he says we can explain behavior through these different areas. And I think the left and right as a psychologist could be defined that way. What a therapist or a coach or whoever says why a person does a thing is because of either these structures and systems or the individual, the embodiment we could talk about. Sufficient anthropology. To be happy, healthy, find meaning, be mentally well, I think you need four things. So the first one is embodiment. A lot of the discourse online is very disembodied. It's people that are intellectuals, that are smart people, maybe cognitively. That's what I was like when I was young. I was smart cognitively, but I wasn't wise. I think it wasn't in my body. I didn't have wisdom. You know, I had to go to martial arts and find a certain physicality. You can't find that in the library. So intellectual ideas are great. And I love geeking out with you on philosophy, but they'll only get you so far. We've actually got to do some praxis, some physical praxis, you know, martial arts, extreme sports, you know, yoga if you're a hippie. There's different things.
Yeah.
So you need to connect to the body. You need to connect to community. So it's great that the Lotus Eaters, for example, are having get-togethers. Just met a young man at the cafe who'd been to one of your get-togethers. He loved it. We've got to get together in real life. Like, you know, I go to a church. Now that is not just a set of ideas. The church I go to is also a set of people. You know, we go to the pub on the Monday night. We have a guys' night. You know, there's a agape where you have cake and coffee and stuff after the church. You know, my fiance meets the other women and she's pregnant, so they're helping her with the pregnancy. Like, that is so important. Like, to have community, how do we do that in postmodern liberalism? We can come back to, because that has been smashed. Community's been absolutely smashed compared to someone, say, in Greece or England in the Middle Ages. Third connection, the environment. You need to get outdoors. Touch grass. That's what the kids say.
Absolutely.
The kids are smart. Like, the kids are getting it. They know you've got to get to the gym. They know you've got to pray and have a church. They know you've got to have some brotherhood. Like, they understand that. And that's why the government's terrified of young men getting together, because they understand that's where revolutions come from. That's where power comes from, is young men getting together. You have a sense of, you know, physicality and spirituality. That's the fourth connection. So you need some sense of, like, I'm 19 years sober. We call it higher power. If you go to an AA meeting, some sense of God, creator, you know, everyone's got their own word for it. Meaning, logos, you know, different approaches. So it's self-regulation, co-regulation, eco-regulation, and to make up a semi-Greek word, theo-regulation. So those four things we need to reconnect to. There's practical things you can do for all of those.
Right.
There's a lot there.
We'll definitely touch upon and elaborate upon each of them. But before we do so, I really want to focus a bit on several of the issues you mentioned and ask you about that. Because I'll say this. I really want to remoralize the audience.
Right.
Or parts of the audience. Because I think various people are so demoralized that they will agree with you cognitively.
Yes.
But they won't feel the power to go out and do it.
Yeah.
And I will say this, is just people focus a lot on power, on what powers we have and what abilities we have, but they don't focus on the exercise of power.
Yeah.
You could have people, for instance, there's the tiresome equality, inequality discourse. Even if we had equal abilities, we would not be exercising them equally.
Yeah.
So it's a focus on exercise. So I think the audience, or a part of the audience, you do have the power to get out. Right, you do. But they don't do so. And it's not just the audience here. I also have some friends in mind.
Yeah.
Because they are people who I'm really worried about. And I want to ask you this about
it. Yeah.
How do we understand that someone is in trouble?
Okay.
Because let me just contextualize, is because I try to tell them somehow to do something, and they just don't listen, and I'm worried about them, because some of them, they're just sat there and they just don't leave at home. You do sense that there is they don't even get angry anymore at their situation.
You sound like a good friend. You sound like a good friend. They're lucky to have you.
But the thing is, though, I will say this, is just I have also been in the past in situations where several people have tried to tell me that if you stop associating with me or stop hanging out with me, I will commit suicide.
Okay, so
and
it's different.
In some cases, at some point, I understood that, no, they're actually trying to manipulate.
Sure.
So I said, I don't care what happens to you.
Yeah. Okay.
So it sounds a bit callous, but
no,
it really was something. And, you know, you could see they were just stealing stuff afterwards.
Yeah.
Also, if they drink sometimes,
they
start talking and they tell you how nasty they are.
Yeah.
How do we discern between the person who wants help wants help, and the person who says, hey, I really want your help, but actually want to blackmail.
All right, great question. I've lost multiple people in my life to suicide, so I don't take this lightly. You know, my best friend from university jumped off Clifton, can't say it, suspension bridge in Bristol. You know, it still hurts me today to think about it. It really harms the people left behind. And it's a very delicate topic. That's the first thing I'd say. I'm going to come to your specific question, but I want to kind of pan out. I think young men are rightly understanding they're mourning. They're not mourning. They know intuitively they've lost something. Their culture's been absolutely violated without consent. Their culture's been absolutely desecrated, would be a good word. And so there's a genuine grief there that needs acknowledging. And you guys have done great work of pointing to the problems. And if we just focus on the problems, it's depressing. And it's very easy to get depressed on the internet or angry. The key thing to understand is our mental health is being attacked continuously by a system that hates us. So it's not accidental that young men have anxiety and depression and addiction, all these different things. They're being kept weak. Absolutely the case. We can go into who and why and, you know, the ins and outs of it. But that's the next thing I'd say, is it's not just on them. There is this bigger picture. But even if something's not your fault, it is your responsibility. It is your responsibility. And we are, if you're religious, you're actually commanded to not despair. Yeah, or anxiety, do not fear. This is the command of Jesus, the Buddha, many other people. So that's the first thing I'd say, is we have a spiritual responsibility there. Now, in terms of practically helping your friends, I think the best thing you can do is be a good role model. So for me, I have a niece and nephew, for example. I can tell them stuff. They don't listen to what I say. But I try and role model being healthy, looking after myself, having a good relationship, spending time outside. And, you know, I'm available if they want to do fun stuff and, you know, encourage my nephew to do martial arts or whatever it is. The role modeling, I think, is always key. In terms of our own friends, at the end of the day, you can't save everyone. And we do have to be selective. So if you think someone's just manipulating you, there is a time and a place to hold boundaries around that, for sure. Now, how do we help people other than role modeling? It's very difficult to tell anyone what to do. I tend to take more of a coaching approach. It's a bit more like Socratic dialogue where you can ask questions and draw it out. That can be helpful. If somebody's a genuine suicide risk, and for example, if someone was telling me about very specific plans for suicide, for example, there's something called suicide first aid that people can look up. And that's even an untrained person who's not a psychologist can look up that. You know, obviously there's the helplines, Samaritans, different things. What I would say is what young men need for mental health is not what most woke psychologists or female therapists will be recommending. So most psychologists are either feminine or female. So I went to university in psychology, 90% of people there were female and left-leaning, right, as well. So it's like feminine and female. Usually what's recommended is you just have to talk about your feelings. That's on the list. It's not bad, but it's not the most important thing. Like, for me, for example, why I'm not mentally unwell now compared to how I was when I was a teenager, it's because my life's good. It's because I've built a good life. It's like, yes, I've got those four connections. So let's say you're depressed. All right, you're a bit down, not clinically depressed, but you're a bit down. Go outside, exercise. If you can't make it to the gym, go for a little walk. Talk to your friends. Yes, talk to a therapist if you want. And most of all, that connection to higher power, those four reconnections. If you can encourage people to do those, they will get better and their lives will be happier. Now, people in the comments are going to say, oh, I did all those and it didn't work for me. And okay, so there are levels. Maybe you go from awful to okay, okay to good, good to great.
Right, okay. So I have two cases in mind
that
I want to ask you about. Actually, three. First is when it comes to insults, right?
Insults.
And I don't use the word pejoratively.
Sure.
I have a really good friend who has absolutely no excuse of being an incel.
An incel, did you say? Yeah, okay, good.
Yes, because he had a really, I know for a fact, he had a very attractive lass that he actually liked.
Okay.
Trying to, you get what I mean. And he was sort of taken aback and it didn't work. But the point is, I'm trying to tell him, you have to go out.
Yes.
You have to go out and meet women and try. And you only want one day to work.
Yeah.
So he always tells me, that's very rich of you to say you're with your wife for 12 years, you are lucky. And whatever you did and worked in your case, it just doesn't work in me. So why go out? Women are radical.
Yeah.
Their brains have been fried by radical feminism. I go out. They constantly talk about TikTok and all this stuff.
Sure.
And they just... I'm just going to spare my money. So how do I tell this person to go out?
Yeah.
So he makes me think, well, you can't help people who don't want to be helped.
Yes.
That is
I think that's
a maxim, but I don't want to think that about my friend.
I mean, you're a great friend by the sound of things, but there's people you can help and people you can't.
Yeah.
There's people that have but a little dust in their eye and there's people that have a whole plank.
Yeah.
You know, so there's certainly, I've learned this as a coach. There is people who are uncoachable. So there are some people I go, okay, let's say someone wants to get sober. Like I'm 19 years sober, right?
Become ungovernable.
So, sometimes their life has to get bad enough.
Yeah.
Sometimes they need a wake-up call. Sometimes they'll snap out of it. Maybe he goes on holiday to Poland and meets a whole load of conservative Polish women and changes his mind, you know? Sometimes you can't help people. And there are definitely people I know. It's the same with my woke friends. You know, I've got friends who are liberal. Some of them are too far gone. You know, some of them, I think, you know what? I think he could probably hear my point of view, even though he listens to a little bit too much mainstream media. Others, I think, you know what? They're just indoctrinated. Like, listen, I don't know, a woke woman that's had five abortions or, you know, someone's trans their kids or something. You're not going to be able to convince them. They're too invested in it.
Yeah.
So, while I love your intention, I don't think you can help everyone. There's no one magic bullet. And I think we are living in a time of this meaning crisis. Doesn't mean a lot of people are despairing. The message I would say to young guys is, okay, despair means you're neutered. You're impotent if you're despairing. We don't have the luxury of despair you know, this work that needs to be done in the world. I was just in London. I was looking around and I was seeing sort of a lot of drug addict guys in England now. A lot, like way more drug addicts than I remember when I lived here. And I go, that's not acceptable. I see a lot of people who are obese, like some fucking, they're Disney adult kind of, you know, on their scooters and stuff. A lot of people who are like suckling on their little vapes, smoking weed in the morning all day long. I mean, yeah, I get it. You want to relax on a Friday night or whatever, but it's late in the day. We need actual men who are strong, who can do things. You don't have the fucking luxury of despair anymore. Like that time is over.
Right. Okay. I will push you a bit on this, not because I disagree with you, but because I want to try and convey the doomerist sentiment that some people have. It's just, they'll tell you, well, yeah, there's lots of work to be done in the world, but the world is already bad.
Yeah.
The world doesn't want me to help it.
Yeah.
The world is already too far gone. And whatever I do in the present conditions, it just won't help.
Yeah. So plant a tree, even if the world ends tomorrow, number one. Number two, you'll feel better for doing it. Like if I lift, do something simple. I push a weight. I'm changing the world. I'm moving this from A to B. Afterwards, I'm in an empowered state. I feel good. My hormones are going
to
change.
You impose your will to the world.
Yeah, that's very Nietzschean in a way. Like, when I go to the gym, I'm doing it for my physical health, but I'm doing it for my mental health. It's like I have changed something. I've done something. And, I come out of there feeling more potent, more capable, and more attractive to my fiance. I walk down the street in a different way. You know, other men treat you differently. Like, it's, I'm in a deload week this week, and I'm missing it. I'm really missing it this week to work out. You can see I'm not the fittest guy, but that's from a mental health point of view, it's fantastic. Not just mental health, we could say embodiment. There's a embodiment of a philosophy in doing martial arts or lifting weights, for example. So that's the first thing I'd say is also, who are you going to be around, right? Like, I want to be around the people who are trying to do something. Now, I don't know the guys here at Lotus Eaters, right? But I can guarantee if I ask anyone in their office to come for dinner, I think they'd be a cool, interesting guy. Why? Because they're on a mission. They're doing something important in the world. Now, even if they wake up and go, oh, there's no point, it's all depressing, and we're just pissing in the wind. Like, look at what you guys have achieved. Like, just this little studio, I won't say too much, too many details, but this little studio, you've achieved so much. And it's like, I started off with one guy who said, you know what, I've had enough. Was it Carl just wanted to play computer games, I think, originally? And it's like, he said, no, bollocks, enough's enough. So big things can grow. You can do things. And worst case scenario, you make some really cool friends. Maybe you don't put the ring back into Mount Doom, but it's the friends you make along the way is the cliche, but that's true. Like the stuff I've done in my life, some of them made me money, some of them didn't, some of them did great things, some of them didn't. But always, like, if I think of who's coming to my weddings, people from all these different countries that I've connected with through these projects. And I don't know, I'd rather wake up in the morning and feel like I'm going to do my bit. And the other thing I'd say is I have hope. Like the two young guys I just met in the cafe, just before I met you, the kids are all right. There's a lot of young guys doing cool stuff, reading Nietzsche, reading BAP, this guy was telling me. And he didn't look like a right-wing guy. This is just a guy at the Costa Coffee. So I see young guys doing good stuff. The culture's already turned. Like we live in material modernity and it hasn't worked. It's clearly failed. Everyone knows it's failed. Like people can see it hasn't worked. It's led to hell. It's led to physically great, yes, but psycho-spiritual hell. And because of that, everyone's looking for something else. So personally for me, I've got, despite the dark, clearly Babylon, London I've just been in with all its problems, despite that, I have lots of hope.
Same. I do think that was my impression when I was teaching. I think most young people are all right. But where does reality and demoralization come apart? Because in one respect, us in news have to talk about bad things.
Sure.
Because people have to find out about bad things in order for them to not get worse.
I mean, I watch you guys every week, but I can't watch you every day
because
it just depresses me too much.
Yes.
I want to know what's going on. And I trust you guys as a source. You're my main source of news, And my fiance is like, is that Carl again? She can hear his voice on my phone in the morning.
Yes.
But it's, I can't watch the news every day.
Right. Okay. So I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I really follow one of your suggestions of going out Doris.
Yeah.
Every weekend I tried to travel.
Yeah.
And if not both Saturday and Sunday, at least one day.
You were climbing mountains this weekend, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you feel depressed on top of a mountain, looking down on God's creation?
No.
Of course not.
No, actually.
It's almost impossible to feel depressed on top of a mountain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, you're correct. So I went to Wales, as I was saying. I did the Four Falls Trail in the waterfalls in Brecon Beacons. I did a 3-hour trekking under the rain, and really good for me. There was no signal reception. I kid you not, I was about a day off social media.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was a 2-week break.
It's a relief, huh?
Yes.
It's absolute poison.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Instagram because for my work, basically, right? I do workshops on meaning of life. And yeah, I do like advertising marketing on Instagram. I post and I get the hell off the app.
Yeah.
Because it's like walking into a bad neighborhood to get something I need.
But that's what I want to say here is that I post pictures every now and then because I want to share with the audience good pictures.
Sure.
And I want to tell people it's important to bear in mind that good things exist.
Yeah.
They should go outdoors. It's going to be good for them. And, you know, just look at the beautiful places you can go.
Right.
And throughout the entire country. There aren't a few good places. There are many good places.
Where I live, Slovenia is fantastic, but Britain's good, man. I lived in Brighton. God help me living there. But, you know, there, you're not so far away from the South Downs. You know, you've got the lake. I grew up walking around the Lake District, the Peak District.
Yeah.
Wales is fantastic. Cornwall, Devon, there's so many places.
Yeah. So I will post these pictures and I will always have people saying, well, yeah, but there were many tourists there. Or imagine that there is a mosque there. Or, you know, why are you showing me
which
this?
Which camera's on? But, look, you got you doomers depressing this poor Greek man. He's from a sunny country where there's nice food and hot brunettes, and you're leaving your doomer comments depressing the poor bloke. Unbelievable.
I mean, no, to be honest, I'm not depressed. I'm just saying people go out, travel.
Yeah.
I have a list of places.
Get outside. I'm outside 3 hours a day. So all my business calls are on the phone, not on Zoom. I walk up and down the river in the town I live in every day in the trees. I mean, I happen to live in a nice place. That's deliberate for me, actually. You know, in Brighton, I used to walk around the park in Brighton along the seafront. I coach people for a living.
Were you in the gay or the lesbian district?
I wasn't, no. I did accidentally book my mum into a gay a hotel while she was visiting one day.
Was that Kemp Town?
She was in Kemp Town. She said, two lovely men are running places. I said, mum, where are you staying? I'll book you in, but I don't remember the name. She goes, oh, Boys Den. It's called Boyzden. No, so it was a fun place to live. But there's always somewhere you can go that's a bit nicer, get a bit of nature. We call it eco-regulating. And for me, for example, I charge more money if someone wants Zoom calls and not a phone call because I want to be outside. I want to be sitting in the Botanic Gardens or sitting on a bench by the river. Yeah. You know, I live in a Disney movie, man. I've got like a favorite heron where I live, you know, like there's wild fowl and birds and forests and I'm very lucky. But I've also designed my life that way, you know. Like,
so how do we get young men and young women who watch us and get demoralized by bad news?
Yeah.
To live more. I'm not saying you're not living. I'm trying to get you to live more.
This is such boomer dad advice, isn't it? As well, we're like the uncle is go outside, kids. Look, they know it. I think the younger generation, they get that the internet is toxic. Actually, I think it's maybe the millennials that, and some of us Gen X who maybe don't get it.
Right.
Like the young ones, they understand that it's toxic.
Okay, so I think there's a problem here.
Though. Yeah.
I know lots of old people, boomers plus, who know that the TV is toxic,
right.
But they watch
still it. Watch it.
They still watch it. So I'll give you an example. My grandmother, she passed away a few years ago. She was 96. She hated a center-left channel in Greece, and she was only watching that.
Yeah.
I was asking Grandma, why are you watching this channel? You say you hate it.
Hard not to look.
She was telling me, I want to see if they have any sense of shame ever. And her verdict was always that they're shameless. but she knew how bad it was.
Yeah, cognitive knowing's not enough though, is it?
Yeah, she knew how. And also, it's not that hard because legacy media aren't endless.
Right.
There are, you know, five, six big channels.
And the algorithms.
People do watch
them. Yes. Is
that, plus the algorithm.
Yeah,
so the idea that the young generation knows that online spaces are do have the potential of toxicity doesn't mean that they are going to go offline.
Yeah, yeah. They are going offline a little bit more, looking at the data. So that's the first thing, the younger ones. There's a skepticism towards it. So I think people are learning. The other thing I'd say is if your life's good enough, when you make your life good enough, you don't want to reach for your phone. So I notice this, like if I'm in church in a great service with people I love, I don't want to reach for my phone. If I'm outside in nature having a nice time, I don't feel like it. Even if I'm in the pub talking to some good friends, having a good night, bantering, swearing, singing, you know, whatever, I don't feel like looking at my phone. So that's the other thing is you do have to replace it with something. As I said, the more you get in your body, the more you co-regulate, the more you eco-regulate, the more you have some kind of higher power that you can connect to. Those four things, if you keep doing those four things, the phone stops being so appealing. The other thing I would say is let's cut people some slack. Like, this is the most addictive technology that's ever been invented. Yeah, this thing. Like, this is a gateway to hell. I'll give a fun example. There are more titties on this phone than all of my ancestors have ever seen combined. Like, I do not watch porn.
It doesn't sound particularly bad.
It does. It doesn't, does it? And that's how they get you. Because it doesn't sound bad. So
you have to have Canon appreciators.
Yeah, Canon.
You have to cut me some slack here.
Liberal modernity says do what you want, have fun, and it pretends that's heaven.
Yeah.
And actually it's hell. Okay. So just neurologically, I interviewed Anna Lemke on my podcast who wrote Dopamine Nation. She looks at all the neuroscience of this. You'll get addicted to that. And it sounds great. I can look at naked girls, but then it's like, well, of course, you know, if you're a young guy, that's very tempting. I mean, I grew up in the era of, you know, magazines only kind of thing. So I'm glad I got off any kind of stuff like that before AI porn or whatever people do now. For me, it's this is the most addictive technology. Social media, porn, some of the AI social stuff that's coming in is going to be even worse. This is crack, right? This is a serious addiction. Now, I think there's a lot of young guys who aren't going to overcome it. Despite, I love that you want them to. I think there's a lot of young guys who are going to get hooked in this, who are going to be on the porn, if not on the drugs, you know, the fentanyl, whatever it is, but they're going to be stuck on the electronic version of that. And they're not going to have a great life. And they're going to be in hell. But there's another group of young men who are going to have to be saints. They're going to have to be Buddhas. There's a group of young men, some of whom I mentor or come to my workshops. Think of a young guy who came to my training yesterday in London. He's on top of it. He doesn't watch porn. He doesn't do drugs. He goes to the gym. He prays. And I go, wow, what it's breeding, this is like the ultimate moral willpower gym. You know, I have to walk around all day with this thing in my pocket where I could, you know, see that if I wanted. And it's like, wow, that's actually building a generation of fucking superheroes. That's how I look at it. But yeah, there's a whole lot of people who are going to be lost to that and they're going to be in hell. That's true.
All right. So I want us to focus a bit on your model of human flourishing.
Yeah.
And let me add to what you said before. You mentioned that technology and the algorithms and set particular platforms are incredibly addictive. I think this gives us a good gateway to thinking about virtue ethics in a sense, because in virtue ethics, no action is isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Every action is part of a disposition. It's not part of a disposition, but indicative of a disposition. And it isn't just something, an event that takes place and has some immediate consequences and then the clock stops.
Mm-hmm.
It's always an action that brings forth some consequences, a chain of consequences.
Yes, and you're building a muscle.
And
yeah.
It reinforces habits.
Yes, yes.
This is what people forget. So that's what I'm troubled with, is that there are people who will constantly use their mind against them.
Yeah, they're in a...
And some of them want to be this way because they feel that this is a comfort zone for them.
Yeah.
They are. This is what's familiar to them. They're familiar with feeling bad about themselves.
It's comfortable.
It's comfortable. And in a weird sense.
Right.
It's not like, necessarily something that makes them feel good.
It's different.
Familiar
is not the same as good, right?
Yeah.
I mean, cross your arms. You can try this at home. cross them the other way, it will feel weird.
Yeah.
It's not any better or worse. Since with your fingers, just try that. It's like one way feels normal, one way feels weird. It's just because you've done one way a lot. For your whole life, you've crossed your arms a certain way. You try it the other way, it feels strange. So people do what's familiar, not what's good for them. We are creatures of habit. There's a sort of conservative, in one sense, where we conserve energy, attention, by just doing what we've always done. I mean, Aristotle, you know, you're Greek. I don't have to tell you this. The Greek, I work with a Greek, and she always says, we invented everything first, and they normally bloody did. Okay, so Aristotle's whole thing about you are what you practice, and you become, you know, ontological approach, you become what you practice. That's true. And this is my real expertise, actually. I've spent my entire life studying this, starting when I was 18 or 16 with yoga and martial arts. And there's lots of different what's called embodied practices. So yes, you can think about something, you know, read the book, do Stelios's virtue ethics course. I did it. I watched it twice. It's very good. Thank you very much, sir. I recognize this office actually from the course. I was like, oh, I'll check that out when I go there. Anyway, so the theory is good. You need the theory because the theory guides the praxis, but the praxis builds the muscle. That's what builds the habit. You know, like I'm away from home right now. My fiance is not here. My social support. I'm in a hotel in London last night. And I'm like, I'm glad I have the habit of not drinking, not watching porn. You know, I have the habit of getting up this morning. I got up, went, tried to go to a church, and there was loads of drug addicts outside it. But it's like, I'm in the habit of, I found a park to sort of, even in London, I found a little park to have a bit of nature. I did my morning rosary prayer and meditation. You know, I'm in the habit of it. It would feel weird for me to not pray in the morning now. It's just what I do when I wake up in the morning, even when I'm traveling.
Yes.
So, yeah, if you can build those habits, that will change how you think. So you're trying to talk to these depressed friends or students or whatever, but their whole thinking is coming up from their embodiment. You know, it's like, try being depressed while bench pressing. You cannot do it. You're in a different embodiment,
right,
in a powerful mode.
Okay, so that's the first part of your four embodiment. Right, okay. I want to ask you this about being present.
Yes.
So you said that when you're trying to bench press.
Yeah.
You don't feel depressed or something because you're in the moment.
Yeah. It's enforced mindfulness.
Right.
You could say.
Okay. So really small parenthesis.
Yeah.
I feel this way frequently also with horror movies. It's just with horror movies, I'm always present.
You'll be present, but you'll be stimulated to be in an unpleasant state. So it's different. So you're present,
yes.
But that presence is enforced by an external stimuli in both cases.
Okay.
The trick is to build the skill of presence without the crutch of the intense stimuli.
Of a demon about to possess you. Or
yeah, so the intense stimuli might be a scary movie, it might be a hot girl, it might be an intense bench press. All of those are external stimuli. So they, you know, it calls the attention to mind, right? The skill, you know, this is an interviewer, is to be present when that's not happening,
yes.
Right? So yeah, so this is what meditation or meditative prayer, like if I'm doing a rosary, I mean, yeah, there's a various aspects to that, but one aspect to that is I'm just trying to stay present. Because I'm like, Hail Mary, full of grace. And then it'll be like, oh, what am I doing later? Oh, I've got the interview. It's still on. I'm going to come and you keep, like, that's the meditation. It's like a mindfulness principle. You keep coming back to it. For in Orthodox Christianity, it's the Jesus prayer. Same principle.
Right. So the first principle is embodiment.
Yeah.
What do people miss about embodiment, especially when they're over-intellectualizing things?
Well, they don't do any.
Because this is, for instance, I have this friend, talking to you about who has an intense problem with talking to women he has this ideology in his mind according to which he is the victim of the world and the system and blah blah blah, and he will always think about this.
So I mean, he's up in his head straight away, right?
Yes. Like, how do we get someone who lives in his own head to live in the real world?
I mean, any embodied practice is good. So the first thing I'd say is, for any young guy, find something you love. For me, it was martial arts. For some people, it's yoga. More hippie friends of mine do conscious dance, for example. There's a whole range of things out there. Some people like Tai Chi. It's real slow. Personally, I can't stand it. I'd rather be lifting weights these days, you know? Some people like jiu-jitsu. It's like anything that you enjoy that gets you in your body. That's the first thing I'd say. And depending on, you know, old guys watching this, they might need that general Tai Chi practice. For young guys, something physical, something competitive, maybe jiu-jitsu, kickboxing, whatever, you know, get out there. And you might have to build it up. Like if you're scared to go into a Thai boxing gym, start with Aikido. You know, start with something a bit more chill. So there's...
Be Steven Seagal.
Please don't. Please don't. He's an embarrassment, the Aikido world. Yeah. But I've got stories about him. But that's enough for another time. What I would say is just find something you love.
Yeah.
So if you don't love the gym, don't go to the gym. Find badminton, whatever. Find something you personally love.
Golf.
Golf's a bit tame. I'm not sure I could bring myself to recommend ruining a good walk that way. But I mean, anything's better than nothing. At least you're outside. Yeah, at least you're moving. I'd say it needs to be something that you enjoy that gets you in your body. If it's building a more rigorous masculine disposition, even better.
Right. So what's the second
part of the model?
Second part of the
co-regulation.
Co-regulation.
So we tend to think of it like mental health comes from talking to a therapist once a week. Bullshit. Mental health comes from being in a village. So I grew up in a literal village in the east of England, for example. Accents change now, but I grew up in a village where you knew your neighbours, right? You didn't always get on with all of them, but you knew people. I mean, now I live in a small town, people recognise me and I walk down the street, say hello to people, right? So co-regulation comes from building community, which has been destroyed by liberal material modernity.
Right, question.
You don't have the village anymore. It has been destroyed and it is hard work to build it.
Right, so lots of people who are going to watching us will be living in cities. And they're going to ask question, how do I co-regulate in cities?
Yeah, it's harder.
Lots of people may not even know their neighbor.
Yeah, well, say hello.
There may be a corpse upstairs and for disintegrating.
That is the sad situation we're in.
Without noticing.
So
that's from a movie. We didn't.
There's no one upstairs.
I think that's from As Good As It Gets.
I don't know that one. So there's things we can change and things we can't. So the basic serenity prayer, you've heard of that, is, you know, change the things you can, leave the things you can't. So if you live in a city, it's good news in one way because you can probably find like-minded people. So you have to put up a flag. You have to find those people. Maybe you find them in church. Maybe you find them in jiu-jitsu. Maybe you, you know, put a thing on Facebook. Like, you need to put a flag up. You need to find like-minded people.
Build a community.
Exactly. And then you need to invest in it. So there's a few levels of this. So I have global community. So I'm going to like a men's retreat for some business guys that I know in a few days' time after, you know, I'm going to the ARC conference. So I meet a few people and I'll, you know, talk to a few people there. I have the Irish superpower skills from my grandparents so I can make friends and chat to people. You know, you saw me just in the cafe meeting a couple of young guys. It's easy for me to do. So that is a skill you can build to make friends. But it's also about commitment. You know, Monday night is guys' night at the pub. It doesn't matter if I don't feel like going out. I go out. You know, that's what I do. Friday night's my AA meeting. I go, you know, I help young guys get sober. That's what I do on a Friday night, right? If I'm in the town, that's what I'm doing. So you have to commit to these things. It's not just like I don't feel like it. So there's a discipline in it. You have to reach out to people. You have to get rejected. You know, like talk to 10 girls. 9 of them reject you. 1 of them won't. You know what I mean? It's like I did a lot of my dating in Russia back in the day that made me bulletproof because it's just like Russian girls just cut you down. Once you've been rejected by dozens of attractive women in Kiev or Moscow, you're bulletproof. Like once you've been rejected by strangers, you're bulletproof. Once you talk to people regularly, like we do for a living, you're bulletproof. So you have to, it's scary. You get rejected when you talk to girls. You get rejected when you make friends. You get rejected when you talk to your neighbors and they don't want to talk to you. But that's work. And if you're extrovert, it's easier. If you're introvert, it's definitely harder. Right? You know, my partner's more introvert than me, so you know, I do a lot of socializing for us and make friends, and she makes friends with the wives of my friends.
Okay, so when it comes to communities, I completely agree with you, and I did so.
Yeah.
Everywhere I've been. But many people who talk about this, and they talk about the disintegration of communities, they live in cities, and they say that the city is very, is just Babylon, as you said. Yeah. But it seems to me that it offers so many opportunities for building communities. So why do people see something that seems to be like an opportunity?
Well, the bigger the city, the more closed off everyone is. I've spent time in Moscow, New York, London, Kiev, places like that. And people are just closed off because
Three, 4 people. You don't need
need a million people. If you've got 3 good friends, you're doing great. You're doing great. You know, there's 3 guys I go to the pub with on a Monday night. You know, there's 10 guys in an IA meeting. Okay, we go to the English Mass in Ljubljana. There's 30 people there.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need hundreds. It is some work, but it is possible. And it's let's acknowledge it is difficult. We're not born in a medieval village. And also there's some serious advantages, right? Like a medieval village, they have religion, but you were told which religion it was. They had meaning. You had a career, but you know, my granddad was a fisherman in Ireland. Okay, the only reason my dad wasn't a fisherman is because my granddad volunteered in World War II. It was called Irish Volunteers, they were called. So he joined the Royal Navy, merchant seamen. so very proud of him. But it's like, otherwise it would be like fisherman all the way back. So yeah. It's like, yeah, you know your job. You don't have to go, what's my life purpose? I do a lot of coaching on that, you know, but your job's given. You know your religion, but it's given. And your community, well, he had three girls to pick from, you know, at the Irish Village dance in Cork, where, you know, the little village in Cork where he was. So it's like, I'm glad he got well with my grandmother, you know. It's like, I've ended up with an Italian girl I met in Croatia, you know. It's so it's the best time and the worst time to be alive. And community is part of that. Like, I can meet people who are philosophically aligned with me. You know, it's like, it's unlikely that you're going to bump into someone in the pub who knows who, I don't know, Julius Evola is or someone, right? But online, you can build those communities. So I have the international communities, the people I visit once or twice a year. I still get together with them. Like, we go into my mate's house in a few days. And then I have the local communities, and then I have the actual neighborhood communities. So it's kind of layers.
Concentric.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So what's the third?
Eco. So we talked about that. That's nature. The hippies are right. Nature is good. The pagans aren't totally wrong.
But don't smoke nature.
Don't smoke too much. But what I would say is, you know, barefoot walking. I do that. Sit by the river. And this is for all sorts of things, right? Yeah. You know, I lived in the west of England for a while. I'd go to the river every single day. It was almost like a ritual. You know, I'd go there.
I feel really tranquil when I look at water.
Very common.
There is nothing. Let me just rephrase. Pardon me, I'm just exhausted.
That's what I mean.
I don't see how the sea can make me feel bad if I observe it. Yeah. And I have been a sailor as well. Huh. I've also sailed some really rough seas.
Yeah.
And I really know how to steer the wheel.
Okay.
I actually find it a bit tranquil or something. I like
it's part of your Greek. It's probably part of your Greek heritage as well.
Maybe. But also I can just sit by and just look at the sea.
A lot of people.
If there's a storm or it's completely tranquil, it always wakes up something good in me.
I used to have a really stressful day, and I'd walk along the seafront in Brighton, and the waves would just wash it away, you know.
Yeah.
Some people, it's mountaintops. I think I like the forest. Green and blue, generally every day. You want to see some green and some blue, just to keep it simple. There's a whole body of work called eco-psychology. There's evidence-based on this. The Japanese have studied it a lot in terms of forest bathing, they call it. There's a whole body of work on it now. There's a whole traditions at Exeter University, Dr. Adrian Harris studying it. There's all sorts of people studying this. So there's a whole evidence base for commons. You know, your gran was right. Go walk in the woods, go climb a mountain, get outside. Yeah. It's not rocket science, but again, it's got to be a discipline.
Yes.
You know, every day I do 15K steps. Okay. Now, you know, it's not marathon running every day, but 15K steps means I'm outside quite a lot. Okay. It means I have to get up early if I've got a day in the studio or a day podcasting or whatever, or I go in the evening. So, you know, I do my coaching calls usually in the day. So if I get 15K steps in, I've been outside plenty.
Yeah. Right. So the other bit I want to talk to you about nature and ask you is just, I can't think of nature being ugly. Except with one exception.
Okay, what's Crawley? Where are we?
I really don't like... I don't think Swindon has bad nature.
Okay.
Swindon has some bad buildings in the city. I don't think it's
the
nature.
The church is nice. There's a high Anglican church that I just go and
I don't
say.
Think it's
nice.
the trees and the grass.
Yeah. It's not
problematic
problem
here, wherever they are.
Well, the West Country is beautiful. I love it. I mean, where I live looks like the Swiss Alps, but I still long for the green fields of England. There's a ethnic and kind of, you know, for me with sort of Anglo-Irish roots, I really feel that when I'm in Ireland or the UK, I really feel that longing for the place. It's, you know, it's hard to be away from that in some ways, even though where I live is beautiful. Where's ugly then? Where do you not like?
No, it's not a place that I find
landscape.
Ugly. It's, I hate it when the weather doesn't know what it wants.
That's England.
Occasionally.
Okay, when it chops and changes.
Not
you don't like it
no,
when it chops
I don't
and
like
changes.
Rapid changes.
Okay.
I want to align myself with.
Are you a bit autistic?
The weather? No.
No? I thought everyone at the Lotus Eaters was, no? Is that...
It depends what you mean.
I'm just messing with you.
Don't want to. I just don't like, you know, the very light, the light gray.
Okay. Okay.
Cloud
you prefer
with lots of sunshine.
If it's rainy or sunny,
yes.
Bit more clear.
Yeah.
No,
be cloudy.
I can
sunny,
relate to that.
Be rainy.
To that.
Just make up your...
What are you doing? Mind. Stop messing about. Yes, yes or no. Karate, yes, baby, exactly. Squish. Yeah, okay, I get it.
Okay, and let us go to the fourth step, which, if I remember correctly, it's theoregulation.
Yeah, theoregulation. It means connecting to meaning or purpose in the secular sense, or we could say higher power or God, if you're not scared of the word.
Right, okay. So how do we find meaning? Let me contextualize.
Yes.
Because I was thinking a lot about it, because it seems to me that people who try to find meaning already feel that in some respects meaning eludes them.
Okay, yeah, I see what you mean.
If you are on cloud nine, if you're in heaven, don't search for meaning.
Well, yeah, if you're deep in a flow state, deeply connected, making love to someone, deep in ecstatic prayer or whatever, you're not thinking, oh, this is, where's the meaning?
Yes. Yeah. So you must feel a sort of gap to say that I have to fill it somehow.
Yeah.
Don't think anything weird.
We're not filling any Greek gaps, okay, guys? There's no jokes. Definitely no jokes about Greeks and gaps and sailors. None of that. All right, let's continue. Meaning. Yes.
Okay, so... Meaning, when it comes to trying to do this, it's just, it seems to me that when people frequently experience something bad in their life, that's when they say consciously, I have to pursue meaning.
Yeah.
I have to find a way. They understand a problem, and then they come, they start saying, I have to find the solution to it.
Yeah.
And I have to make life more tolerable than it already is. Mm. So... they frequently navigate towards listening to other people.
Mm.
At least it's for it's one of the first steps.
Yeah.
The current intellectual orthodoxy for a long time in the Western world, and also in England, there's a particular tradition in of English philosophy.
Okay.
For a long time, they are bombarded with ideologies and worldviews that cannot accommodate meaning.
Right.
Yeah. Let me say, I'd consider a sloppy argument of saying, if you're a materialist, you can't have meaning in your life or you can't be moral. I think you can. But the point is, what I want to say is that people who are materialists and are moral, I think, are moral despite their materialism, not
Got
because
it.
Of their materialism.
Got it. Yeah.
And the problem, the way I see it with lots of these ideologies like naturalism, eliminative materialism, reductive materialism, all of these ideologies that try to eliminate the first person, they are essentially becoming a bad voice in us.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to say, but all of this is a lie.
Yeah.
But value is a lie.
Yeah. So cynicism of
free
the postmodern
will is a
world.
Lie. Yeah, Moral responsibility is a lie. There is no right or wrong. It's all a lie.
Okay.
Because it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
So it sabotages people from trying to guide their thinking in pursuing meaning.
Agree. Yeah.
So what do you how should people theoregulate or pursue meaning?
Okay, first of all,
in this context, where the overwhelming majorities of books that they're gonna open,
let's say
they visit Waterstones, they're gonna
see
Dawkins, Sam Harris, Dennett, you know, all these people who tell them basically the self is an illusion. You're just a meat machine.
Okay, how do we find meaning given that? Okay, so I'm not as good at philosophy as you are. You're the man for this stuff. Okay. The way I look at it is that material modernity doesn't really have a story of meaning. It says stuff doesn't really have a theory of consciousness, of beauty, of goodness, of love, any of the things that make life worth living. It's a philosophically bankrupt culture. Now, when I say philosophy, I don't necessarily mean a book in Waterstones. I mean the sort of default culture, the ethos of the times. So we're in a kind of materialist times, which leads to hedonism as the only sort of, if there's no meaning, you try and medicate yourself with hedonism, which leads to addiction, death, and despair, and all the problems we've talked about. So that's the anti-culture. I call it the anti-culture that we're in, is the machine anti-culture or materialist modernity, if you will, materialist liberal modernity. It doesn't have a sufficient anthropology. It doesn't really have a theory of any of these things that make life worth living. So we could get more into the philosophy and you'd know more than me, I think, about it. But that's my basic story, is the culture, the general culture, the default culture, even if you never go into Waterstones, doesn't offer meaning. Now, another thing I think is helpful is people often say, you know, what's the meaning of life? And I've asked people out on the street. We actually stop people in the street and do coaching with them. And
Were you holding a lamp?
Yeah, they were looking for the classic. Is it Socrates or Nietzsche?
Nietzsche.
No, we stop people in the street like Socrates, like a gadfly, and annoy people. And most people say, oh, to have fun. And it's just sort of some sort of hedonism, unless they happen to be religious. For most people, it's they don't really have any philosophy of life. It's just like, oh, try and have fun. And it's like, that doesn't end well. Like
drinking monster.
Yeah, drinking pints and Stella's the evening, whatever. Yeah. It doesn't end well. And we can see that on an individual level with all the addicts on the street. We can see that on a societal level. Materialism has fucking failed. Let's be honest about it. So what do? We can't go back. We can't LARP as now. I want to retake Constantinople for the Greeks. I get it. Like the idea of crusading, we probably do need a reconquista. We probably do need a crusade. But the idea of LARPing as a sort of pre-modern medieval guy, I mean, I've got my Deus Vault t-shirt on in the gym or whatever, but we can't really go back. And the reason you can't go back is your brain has changed. You've been moderned. I'm subject to the same toxic cynicism and as everybody else. Now, you know, then you're left in the sort of Dawkins mode. You know, I grew up, I was reading Dawkins when I was like 15, 16. And you're like, oh, now what do? Because I'm miserable. And you're being
yeah,
a
he'll
cult-
tell you, but it's true. And truth doesn't care about your misery.
Yeah. And which what I would say is what you need to do there is have an experience that opens up profundity to you. So nobody falls in love logically. You don't fall in love with your partner because you work it out on an Excel spreadsheet. I always feel like Keir Starmer's like, if an Excel spreadsheet bred with a kind of, I don't know, what would it be? Like a Down syndrome Excel spreadsheet. That's his whole vibe, that managerial, like a Excel spreadsheet bred with a Down syndrome pancake. You know, that's what he looks like. It's something gray. That's a kind of gray hell. It's flat. You know, there's something about that that disgusts me and terrifies me. That's not how I want to live. And it's not how we do live. You know, I was in Westminster Cathedral for Mass in London yesterday, right? Stunning. It's neo-Byzantine actually. And as soon as you walk in, you believe in God. As soon as you believe in, you're like, whoa, okay, something's here. It's the same in falling in love. It's the same when you're on top of a mountain. You're experiencing profundity. So I would say to people, how can you experience the divine? How can you experience something which oceanically transcends your life? How can you dissolve into that? Now, you can add a theology and a philosophy later on. That's wise. It's wise to have the cognitive part. You know, the Catholic Church, for example, has a lot of philosophy and cognitive parts worked out. There are different technologies for that. So I know for a fact, if I don't eat for 3 days and I'm in a silent meditation retreat, I will be having visions. Like I will be talking to the saints. And that's just a result of a set of technologies. Some people it's psychedelics. Not always wise if people have mental health problems. Like I have to be a bit careful with those.
Do you have a bad trip?
Yeah. They can make people psychotic. So weed can as well, actually. But yeah, I mean, I've been doing psychedelics since I was 13 years old, but I wouldn't do them too often. My family have a talent for openness. So it means we have schizophrenics and epileptics, but we also, you know, my mum was a mystical Catholic nun for 7 years. She's a novice nun. So this is in our family that we're quite open. Like I can trip balls just by doing a bit of yoga. So some people it comes easily to, and they need to be careful, actually. And this, for example, a little bit of breath work, and I'm already kind of high as a kite. But my partner, she's very logical, very sort of maybe a bit on the spectrum. And she went to a breath work camp with me and she just got a headache. She was like, nothing touched her. But for her, it might be something else. For her, it might be a beautiful Italian church or nature, exercise. So there's a whole bunch of technologies out there which are very practical. And don't believe me. Like, this isn't a logical argument. This is something you experience. And I think once you have those experiences, it just, like, for me, denying the divine would be like denying red. it's just part of experience. Like now, if you were blind, it would be hard for me to explain red. Like philosophically, that's quite a challenge, right? That qualia there. But it's part of my experience on a daily basis. And I think it's part of the normal, I mean, the normative human consciousness is this. Like we were animists for a long time before we were anything else. So this is normal. This is normal to be experiencing this layer of the world.
Right. So I want us to move to the final section of the interview.
Okay.
And to talk about the really hard stuff.
Hmm.
It seems to me that some people really have to be on the edge of the abyss sometimes to find meaning.
Yeah.
And if they don't cross the point of no return, they do find meaning there.
Mm.
Where is that point? And what are you have to be in a particular state of mind to find yourself?
Yes.
Two minutes to midnight.
Well, all of culture has just hit what we'd call in Alcoholics Anonymous rock bottom. So rock bottom is not a certain amount of alcohol or a certain physiological state. It's a spiritual state where you go, I've had enough. Yeah. And then you're ready to surrender. But, I mean, for me, I was 10 years alcoholic and one day I just woke up and went, I've had enough. You know, I've had enough. For other people, it's a really strong experience. Like, you know, I knew a guy who killed his wife in blackout, woke up covered in blood. You know, for him, that was his rock bottom. For me, it wasn't anything as dramatic as that. As a culture, we're hitting rock bottom. And the entertainment industry, the distraction and addiction industry is having to work harder and harder to keep people away from that rock bottom. And I don't think anyone's buying it anymore, Stelios. I really don't think they're buying it. So this is why I'm hopeful, because I think as a group, we're hitting that rock bottom. But it's a dangerous place. You know, when I was younger, I was addicted. I was suicidal. I've stared into that abyss in Ukraine and other places, and it's dark.
So we have talked about culture, but I would like to, you know, make it on an individual basis.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just what makes people think of ending their life?
The guy I'd recommend people follow is called George from the Tin Men. He gives a lot of this sort of scientific evidence based on this, and his real specialism is looking at men's mental health. So I'd really recommend him. While I've looked at mental health a lot in my life, I'm not an expert in suicide prevention. Mm. I think Albert Camus' question of why don't you kill yourself is a perfectly reasonable question.
But would you say that sometimes people can't give a cognitive answer?
I think we've been driven to despair by a culture that hates us, that hates life, that is demonic, frankly, if I'm going to look at it through a religious lens. Through a culture that is evil and has driven a generation of us to despair in various ways. And there's also levels of suicide. There's the quick suicide, like jump off a bridge. But then there's also the slow suicide of the guy who just plays computer games 12 hours a day. He's on Fortnite all day. And you know, that's another kind of suicide. It's just the guy who's just not living fully. I'd say don't let the fuckers win. Right? There's maybe that's my Irish defiance, but I'd say don't let the fuckers win. That's.
Yeah, but the point with this is that it tries to base one's, you know, rebirth on negative feelings and like, I hate the fuckers, therefore I don't want see me die.
So physiologically.
Should we have a positive foundation?
Yes, we should, but physiologically, anger energizes people out of despair.
Yeah.
So there's something called polyvagal theory, for example, you can look at, which when people are in shutdown, getting angry is a good thing. Like, for example, my team were working with a bunch of veterans from the Ukrainian military. They're all in shutdown. They're all traumatized. We took them out in nature. We're doing a body practice, prayer, blah, blah, blah. Then they get angry. And it's like, okay, good. Now we're heading in a good direction because anger has some energy. So like anger is the emotion of violation. Given the state of the West and what's been done to this country, for example, people should be angry. That's not a bad thing, but it's a bad fuel. Long term, it's a bad fuel. It's a toxic fuel.
I mean,
so yes, you will need to get to love on the other side of that.
I mean, I'm thinking of the Iliad, and you mentioned war veterans, trauma, wrath, and trying to control wrath.
Yeah.
This is the Iliad in a nutshell, because you have Achilles who feels justified wrath. Arguably justified.
Yeah.
He is a war veteran. It was a poem written for people back then who would probably be war veterans. It was a way of processing trauma, among other things. And it's about how not being able to restrain your anger dehumanizes you. And you recover your humanity when you end up doing it and all those things. So I agree with you. And this is something that we see in virtue ethics as well, in that people are angry. When they're angry, they frequently don't listen because they don't temper their anger. Okay. They don't moderate their anger. And frequently, if you tell them to, that anger isn't a good counsel, they go against you. They say, no, you want me.
Well, you're stupid when you're angry. So, yeah. I mean, just neurologically, your neocortex is not working very well.
But would you say that this is a healthy sign? If someone is angry, they still have it.
Okay.
Even if they can't say that they're alive. They're alive, yeah. and they do have some fighting energy.
Exactly. So as a way out of despair and shutdown, just neurologically, it's a higher energy state, so it's not bad.
Yes.
I also think it's an appropriate response to violation. So I don't think emotions are important. I disagree with all the American girly psychotherapists who are like, oh, let me tell you about my feelings. I don't care about your feelings that much. But feelings tell you what's going on. So it's like a telephone ringing. The telephone ringing of anger is we have been violated. So it's completely understandable if young men are angry, given the violation that's happened in the West. You know, I was reading about the 250,000 number recently, and I was just in a rage. I was in a rage, and I had to go to church, and I did have to hear that message, thou shalt not kill, which Jesus also said, hey, you could also kill in your brain. Yeah, because why? Because if you want to be smart, if you want to be creative, and you want to have compassion for the people around you, even your enemies, that doesn't mean letting them win, but it means not acting stupidly in fighting them. So if you want to, like, if you see like special forces guys or great athletes, they're not angry all the time. That burns energy. It's inefficient. It's not spiritually, it's toxic as hell. You know, this idea of resentment is like drinking poison and hoping someone else dies. As an energizing move, as a coach, for example, I'll help people get angry to get out of despair, but then you've got to find love. You know, I've got a child on the way. I've got a lot to live for. Like, you know, I'm not waking up angry and shouting at people on the internet. You know, I love my work. Like, I love where I live. I love the communities I'm a part of. And let's get Greek and classy. Nostos. This journey home, that's what we're talking about. Let's go to the Odyssey. Yeah. So this idea of the longing for home, that's the beauty in healthy nationalism. That's what embodiment is. It's coming home to the body. This is the reality, not this, not your internet arguments. What is spirituality if not coming home? You know, I remember when I came back to Catholicism after a big break, I was like, tired of pretending to be an Asian Buddhist or something. It's like sticking feathers up your ass doesn't make you a chicken. You know, it's like coming home was wonderful. The romance, when you're sitting on a bed with a woman you love and you're just chilling out and you've come home. Like, that's what we want. And yes, this siren's on the way, this mobile phone, this is the siren, right? This cyclops, there's all these kind of battles and things and problems, but we're all just fucking trying to come home.
Right. So thank you very much. I think this is a beautiful way to end our interview. And I really enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. And I hope you enjoyed it even more. So Mark, where people can find more of you?
Okay. If you want to read, there's a book called How to Become Human by Mark, just by Mark on Amazon, if you'd like to read. On Instagram, it's Wark Mulch. So the W and the M reversed. If you like Instagram, little videos on there. Don't spend too long on Instagram, but you might find those fun. And Feral Philosophy is our podcast and YouTube channel. Various podcasts on there. People, we did one with Jonathan Peugeot, for example, called Trans Epstein and the Jews. That's a great fun one to start with for anyone new.
Okay. Thank you very much. So do check them out. We will have links underneath. So check them out.
And Efaristo Parpoli, thank you. Your work has been amazing. You, Carl, and all the others, Connor before. The work you do has changed the culture, and it's really made a big difference to a lot of people. There was times I felt so alone, and I'd stick on YouTube, and I go, I'm not mad. These guys get it, and that is a beautiful thing.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.